This is a late night reading from The Gin Girl. The night I had the dream, I was in Memphis. It was unbearably hot, made hotter by the fact that there had been no warning of the coming heat. From the comfortable air of a languid southern winter to a furnace blast like the dog days of August, we were engulfed by humidity. There arose in the city a communal understanding. We were being assaulted by the same curse. Strangers would look at each other on the streets or in the bars and shake their heads as if to say, "Why? What have we done to deserve this?" But there was no answer forthcoming, although I occasionally suspected it was because of something I had left undone, something of primary importance, overlooked on my part, for which the entire southern region was now having to pay penance. To hide from the heat, I sat in the front of my air conditioner in my pay-by-the-week motel room, a dingy end of the line where I watched the flowered wallpaper peel while I drank Jack Daniels from a plastic cup. On the weekends, I tend to bar at a place called Seals. It was easy. I didn't have to look good. I didn't have to make small talk. I didn't even have to smile. And I still got paid enough to get by and drink blackjack and smoke Marlboros instead of generic. I didn't think as much as I had the time to. The night that changed things had been a regular night, one filled with regular customers at the regular seats, crying in the regular drinks. Occasionally, some new face walked in, searching for a bar to call home. Eventually, all the places looked the same, drawn and pale with suggestion of sweat. Some sat huddled away in booths, the seclusion providing a blanket from whatever had driven them out of their lives. Others found solace at the bar, sitting on stools, desperate for conversation, regardless of how disparaging or remote mine might be. In their minds, the close proximity of my presence offered at least a hint of hope. Like someone who sat outside a church thinking, just looking in and thinking, maybe, just maybe. "There are better choices," I wanted to tell them. "Go to Huck's place. He'll remember your name and talk in his loud shout the world down voice and ring his bar bell whether he gets a big tip or he doesn't. Huck likes a lot of noise. It's also alive. Go over there if that's what you're seeking." But incessantly, they were drawn to the damp darkness of my face because it matched their own. The bar had a manager, Tom Ricks, which meant he also had a regular seat. His was at the end of the bar where he drank scotch with a splash. But as the night wore on, the splash wore off, and he was usually drunk by the time we closed. I locked the door, counted what little money that register held, and put it in the floor safe. Tom said, "You're a good kid," even though we were about the same age. I said, "Oh yeah, I'm a good kid," and dumped the tips in my bag without counting them. I relocked the door behind me and started the short walk home, thinking about the heat and how it might be my fault. Seals was surrounded by bars of the same type, a few pool halls, a scattering of rundown stores, a woman's dress shop from a different era, a tattoo parlor offering body piercing, a t-shirt shop that smelled of incense, and the odd assortment of motels that had been turned into a pay-as-you-go arrangement like mine. I opened the door to my room, closed it behind me, and then sat in the only chair, my feet propped on the corner of the bed, smoking and letting the hours at Seals fall away. From somewhere nearby, a blues riff filtered in away out to the sidewalk, rolled a few feet, and died. We were a long way from the gates at Graceland. Intermittently, cars drove past, throwing shadows against the walls. The lights ran over and over the tiny closet, revealing the few pitiful hangers and the white flash of a work shirt. Even in the darkness, the room looked old and tired and sorry to be alive. It had been so long since I had stayed in one place. For no reason, without explanations, I would leave one city and plow into the next. A new one, but just a slight variation on the last. It kept me separate and barren like an estranged, futile fugitive. And now I had enough miles on me to die, and I felt them. every year, every inch, encroaching with stealth as though death would catch me unaware and succeed when I wasn't looking. I closed my eyes and fell asleep. During the course of those numbing hours, in the midst of the half-world on my mind, I began dreaming, and in the dream I was a child playing on the beach with Joe, catching crabs and turning them loose, collecting shells, until our pile grew into a castle, until the castle grew into the world, the salt sitting heavy on our tongues and our skin, and we were laughing like we used to. But in the dream, the sky grew suddenly dark, and I could see my father calling me, waving as though he were trying to warn me of some encroaching danger. But the wind would take his breath away so that I couldn't hear him. He kept waving and waving. The sky was growing darker. The waves grew angry, the spray from them cold and stinging. And then Joe began sinking, as though the sand were eating him alive, the gaping hole of the unseen animal pulling him below the surface. He was up to his waist before I grabbed him by the hands and pulled with all my might. But I was so small, and the sand was eating him so fast. It was to his shoulders, and then above his chin. Then one last desperate look, and he was completely gone. And I was crying and digging, with a freezing wind blowing cold, until I shivered and I couldn't stop. And then someone said, "Mary, it's time to come home." And I turned to see my father, but he wasn't just right, and I awoke with my heart beating against the silence of the room. I could still hear his voice hanging in the air, the words running along my skin, so that the tiny hairs stood up, and I looked around, expecting to see him, as I lit a cigarette with a shaking hand. Tulikwila had surfaced. There is no place in the whole world like the island of Tulikwila. To some people, it doesn't even exist, concealing and revealing itself to whom it chooses. To those of us who were born there, it refuses to let us go, as though we were intertwined. And secretly, I know this to be true. We are. I looked at my hands outlined against the darkness, the strength undeniable, the gracefulness surprising, and I saw before me great green vines wrapping around old oak trunks, as though over the discourse of time, we grew together overlapping one another, the island absorbing the very falls of person, place, and thing with a sleepy ease, so that Percy Falls, who walked back crooked and looked at you through the leaves over his lidded eyes, might as well have been one of those twisted oaks that grew in the grove. The same was true for Redbeard Mahoney, who was and still is the largest man I've ever known, like a swamp cypress, growing straight up, unbending, and even that org of a woman, Lolly Eden, blending with the island when her teeth became as cracked as her concrete motel. Everyone always understood the affiliation between the living things that moved on to Tulikwila and the living things that didn't. Everyone, that is, except my mother. "We aren't Jesus and can't walk on water," she would say through irritated teeth pointed at my father's back. She never spoke of Jesus otherwise and didn't seem to know much about him, but she was quick to point out who we weren't. It was the beginning of a one-sided argument about why we lived in the middle of dirty water and good-for-nothing sand. To my father and me, our home was both mystery and celebration. This has been a late night reading, a selection of The Beginning of the Gen Girl, a novel set in Tulikwila. Yeah, it's one of those mysterious forgotten islands along the coast of Florida. And you can find out more about Tulikwila and all the inhabitants and what takes place. Just go to riverjordan.us, click on books, and you'll be able to follow all the links about the Gen Girl.